Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR. I'm Ron Elving in the city of Washington, D.C.
And courtesy of Iowa Public Radio, I'm Ken Rudin in Des Moines.
Oh, well, Ken, you are our man on the ground in Iowa. So get up off the ground and tell us what's going on out there.
First of all, I think the general consensus is nobody knows what's happening. And, of course, everybody likes to talk about the fact that Iowans are late, usually the kind of folks who decide late. They may not have decided late, but I don't think they want to announce their choices. But it is a wide-open Republican field. Obviously, there have been so many non-Mitt Romney frontrunners over the last couple of months.
And okay, even the different candidates. Have led in at least one Iowa poll done in the last 2 months.
I don't know about Tim Pawlenty, but if you start with, you have Michelle Bachmann winning the Iowa straw poll, then you had Rick Perry. As soon as he got in the race, he was the frontrunner. And then we had Herman Cain, and then we had Newt Gingrich. And now maybe, who knows, we may even have Ron Paul, which is surprising, yes, and maybe not so surprising.
Well, look, he's one of the two people running over 20%. You've got to say he's got a chance of winning.
And he's also built up an organization that he started at least 4 years ago, if not before that. And we always talk about how you always have an advantage of having run once before. Mitt Romney has it. Ron Paul has it. And as we saw by his failure to get on the Virginia ballot, Newt Gingrich clearly does not have that organization you need, especially in a state like Iowa.
All right. Well, Newt Gingrich has got a bigger problem than his lack of organization right now, and that is that he's been so much on the defensive for the last several weeks. It's the stories about his lobbying in Washington for Freddie and Fannie, and it's his stories about supporting Mitt Romney's Massachusetts health care plan before he opposed it, especially on the individual mandate issue, which is so hot right now.
And his criticism of federal judges. Just the other day, he announced that he was opposed to Judge Reinhold. I think he went too far with that.
I think that was going too far. But yeah. he has really staked out some territory in trying to appeal to the hardline conservatives, and that has made him controversial again. Just about every move he's made, including, and most recently, this CNN story that seriously challenges Gingrich's version of what happened in his first divorce. Now, not to bring up really old stuff, but clearly, this is something that does matter to some social conservatives in Iowa, and Gingrich has been saying his first wife wanted that divorce. CNN has come up with pretty emphatic evidence that she did not, and this just keeps him on the defensive one more week.
And you think that, well, maybe, you know, is somebody's personal life a big deal? I think in a state like Iowa, where evangelical Christian conservatives are very strong, as we've seen since Pat Robertson's strong second-place finish in 1988, is a very important and potent movement here. And for somebody, you know, again, to have, you know, look, he's a converted Roman Catholic. He has apologized for past mistakes. He has asked for forgiveness.
He's a 68-year-old grandfather, as he likes to say.
He has asked for forgiveness, but again,
This is Newt Gingrich as we have known him back over 20 years. He does brilliant things at times. He is fantastic in a debate setting, or he's fantastic in a speaking setting. He can really win people over sometimes, even in small, intimate groups. But then, you know, you start looking at the full picture of the man, and he finds himself quickly trying to apologize for things or explain things that he's said or done in the past. And right now, for example, he's taking a lot of hits still for that ad he made with Nancy Pelosi in favor of doing more to stop global warming. He said it's the dumbest thing he's ever done. And yet, at this point, you have to wonder where it stands on the list.
Well, exactly. And I think, you know, when he was moving up in the polls is because voters would see him in the debates. There have not been any debates for at least a week, if not almost 2 weeks. And now it's not only the ground game here in Iowa, but it's also on the tube. And on the tube, Newt Gingrich is getting clobbered by the super PACs. I mean, this is what happens. We always seem that we see the front runners and then they get taken down. But Newt Gingrich, look, he had baggage to begin with. We thought he was all but finished when his staff basically and the campaign collapsed back in April or June or whatever it was. But now it just seems like that all the old controversies that he's been involved in have just coming to the fore with less than a week to go before the Iowa caucus.
It's really only thing that's changed since last summer is really the weakness that the other candidates in the field have shown. We assumed Rick Perry would run a stronger campaign. We assumed that Mitt Romney would get over some of his interpersonal appeal problems. And we thought that this would be a stronger field, so we didn't think Gingrich would have a chance. The truth is they've proved to be such a weak field that Gingrich has actually risen to the point of being in some sense a contestant, even though it doesn't appear he's going to win in Iowa.
And another thing that's surprising to me in Iowa is the going back, the hearkening back to the old Ron Paul political newsletters that Paul ostensibly was responsible for in the years he was out of Congress in the early 1990s. Now, we knew about this stuff. These are newsletters where people have put in anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-gay, anti-immigrant rhetoric. And, of course, Ron Paul, as he said 4 years ago, he said, look, I didn't write this. It's abhorrent to me. I'm not responsible for it. But, one, it did go out under his name. And, two, maybe nobody paid attention to it 4 years ago because Ron Paul was not expected to go anywhere. But there is a strong sentiment for Ron Paul here in Iowa. But even if Ron Paul wins, that's not the worst news that Mitt Romney could come away with.
No, it might not be, because the worst thing really for Romney would be to have Gingrich emerge as his main rival. At this point, if his main rival is Ron Paul, and they slug it out in New Hampshire, and we'll see what happens there. But Ron Paul is not going to make the long haul. He is not likely to be the nominee of a party that believes in having a strong military and that believes in a certain amount of federal power, a lot more than Ron Paul does. Even though Republicans may be the small government party, there aren't that many Republicans prepared to cut 80% of the federal government.
It's interesting that, you know, so many of the candidates you would think would be most palatable to the evangelical wing of the party, like the Rick Santorums, the Michelle Bachmans, they're not showing much strength there. There's some rumor, there's some sense here that Santorum may be on the ascendancy. Now, I don't know if that means from moving from 4% to 8%, but there's a sign that there are more and more people coming out to hear him speak, although I suspect that with the less than a week to go before the caucus, everybody's getting bigger and bigger crowds. He's getting some endorsements from pastors, from he got the endorsement of Bob Vanderplatz, the strong social conservative here in Iowa. But I just wonder if somebody does pay the ultimate price after Tuesday's results, and they may not be around come New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Florida.
That's probably going to be the case, but it's not clear yet who it's going to be. So to sum up, in Iowa, we're expecting either Ron Paul or Mitt Romney to come out on top, with Gingrich to place. And so the three tickets out of Iowa would be theirs. And then we see who among the other candidates might do well enough to survive. The next question mark becomes New Hampshire. We're going to be in New Hampshire doing the podcast a week from now. Who do you like in New Hampshire?
Well, I'm going to be with you next week in New Hampshire. I think I like you, Ron Elving.
All right. Well, here's the tradition. The tradition is the Iowa winner does not necessarily do that well in New Hampshire. Go back 4 years, neither of the two Iowa winners in the two parties did anything in New Hampshire.
There's a history of that. We saw 1980, we have George H.W. Bush winning in Iowa. Ronald Reagan won the primary there. 1988, we had Bob Dole winning the Iowa caucuses. George H.W. Bush winning New Hampshire. 1996, we had Bob Dole winning in Iowa. We had Pat Buchanan winning it. And, of course, in 2000.
All right, you convinced me.
Yeah.
You convinced me. Is the Granite State just that different from the Hawkeye State, or what's the deal?
Well, they are different. And, of course, the evangelical vote that figures so strong here is not that big in New Hampshire, as we saw 4 years ago when Mike Huckabee, of course, who won here, did not do so well in New Hampshire.
So the best thing we can say about Iowa is that when good things happen for you there, they don't necessarily continue. But when bad things happen to you there, they often continue. It is oftentimes a place where people's hopes get buried.
Well, yes, and there's truth, but there's also the obverse to that, and the fact that George H.W. Bush finished third in Iowa in 1988 and came on to win New Hampshire. So it's back and forth. I think that they have kind of a weird relationship with each other. But the one thing that's different, certainly, is the name of John Huntsman, who we haven't heard of. We're not going to hear from Iowa, but we might hear from in New Hampshire. And two, Mitt Romney's basic protective wall has always been New Hampshire. The thought was
one of his
maybe
home states.
Well, one of his home states. I mean, he has a home there. He was a governor in nearby Massachusetts. And he always felt from the beginning that even if he doesn't pull out a victory in Iowa, this is his firewall was going to be in New Hampshire. But that was the same case 4 years ago. Even if he was going to lose in Iowa, he was going to win New Hampshire. But once he lost in Iowa, his support crumbled in New Hampshire as well. So I don't think really we can even imagine to begin predicting what's going to happen in New Hampshire until next Tuesday night in Iowa.
All right, and we do have to mention, too, that in New Hampshire, independents can vote, and they are oftentimes a big factor in the Republican primary there. So one other name we haven't mentioned who is a candidate who is going to be in the Iowa caucus, Barack Obama.
Yes, there is a Democratic caucus on Tuesday as well, and President Obama is not being challenged for renomination. And we've seen in the past that presidential candidates who do go on to lose, like Gerald Ford in 76, like Jimmy Carter in 1980, like George H.W. Bush in 1992, they had serious challenges from within their party. And where they don't, like Bill Clinton did not, like George W. Bush did not in 2004, and like Obama does not, that enables him to save a lot of money, focus on the opposition, and shore up whatever deficiencies or weaknesses you have on your own flank.
Okay, now speaking of weaknesses and deficiencies, we've seen some candidates who were in the running at one time, at least theoretically, in the Republican field, who have never really made much of an impact on that field, starting to talk about running third party. Thinking here first about former New Mexico Governor Gary Johnson.
Well, Gary Johnson, of course, was not treated well by the Republican Party. He only made, I think, maybe one or two debate performances. Of course, the criteria for many news operations was that he have a certain number in the polls. He never achieved it, and therefore he was not in the debates. Of course, Gary Johnson would argue that the reason I never got the number is because I wasn't in the debates to begin with.
Well, so the same reason you and I weren't in the debates.
Right, because we're going to...
Because we never got the number.
So Gary Johnson announced this week that he will seek the Libertarian Party nomination for president. I guess the last Republican to drop out of the race for president and run as a third party was probably John Anderson in 1980. But Gary Johnson was not even an asterisk in this contest. And, of course, maybe in a close race, he might play a role in November. But I suspect that he's not. First of all, he may not have a sure shot to the Libertarian nomination.
What if Ron Paul decides he wants it?
Exactly.
He had it in 1988 when he wasn't nearly as famous as he is today.
Right. He only got 1% of the vote back then. But now, I mean, he has a solid group, a core constituency, many Democrats as well, Democrats and Republicans. And ultimately, that's what a third-party candidate needs. You need dissatisfaction with both the Democrats and Republicans. And theoretically, if Ron Paul decides to run as a Libertarian, he might have that dissatisfaction working on his behalf. Not to win, of course, but to certainly make a difference.
Okay, so Gary Johnson is leaving the Republican Party to run as a Libertarian. And I understand the Republican Party has suffered another grievous loss, as another former Republican has said he is leaving the party and may run as an independent.
Well, we talk about Donald Trump because we can and we should, although it's just, I think Donald Trump, in my mind, and I think Ron, your mind as well, is a roll of the eyes kind of candidate, that he loves the attention. He always threatens to run. He's threatened to run many, many times.
He is a major roll of the eyes candidate.
He is a major roll of the eyes. And, of course, once The Apprentice is over in May or June, then maybe theoretically he gets enough ballots to get on the ballot in 50 states and run as an independent. But ultimately, I still think this is all about publicity and he doesn't run.
All right. But there is somebody out there who is in the process of getting on the ballot in all 50 states and just this week got qualified on the ballot in California as a political party. And it's a group most people haven't heard of yet called Americans Elect. And they say they're going to nominate a candidate later this year online. And all you need to do to participate in their nominating convention online is a computer and a connection to the Internet. Are they going to have an impact?
Well, there are some people who believe that there's such dissatisfaction with the D's and the R's that Americans Elect will perhaps even elect the president in November. I'm far from convinced of that. You know, first of all, you have to have a ton of money. It's one thing to have ballot access. But look, Ross Perot was on the ballot in 50 states. He had $60 million, which was a record amount back in 1992. And how many electoral votes did he get? Zero. So, you know, you could talk about third party. This is still a two-party system. I don't think the Democratic rank and file are going to desert President Obama. And if Mitt Romney or whoever the Republican nominee is, if polls show that he or she is within striking distance of beating President Obama, then I think the Republican Party will probably stay pretty together as well.
Speaking of the two parties, Ben Nelson is retiring. And I suppose you could say that Ben Nelson came as close to being in both parties as any current member of the Senate.
That's a very good transition, Ron. And I think there's some truth to that because as much as liberal Democrats despise Ben Nelson because he voted with Republicans far more often than they wished, the fact that he was hardly true to Democratic principles, but now that he has announced this week that he will not seek a third term Democratic senator from Nebraska, Ben Nelson's departure almost assuredly gives the Republican Party another seat in the Senate where they need four seats to take control, three if they take the presidency. And, you know, they're talking about maybe Bob Kerry comes back from the new school to run for the seat. I don't buy that for a second.
I think
even though the Republicans are beating each other up in the primary, there's a very tough primary between the attorney general and the state treasurer. There's some rumors that Governor John Heineman will come in, or at least Republicans want him to come in.
Regardless,
I think that the Republicans do take that seat in Nebraska.
All right, so Ben Nelson retires. Maybe it does not change the ideological mix much, but on the other hand, it probably creates a more reliably conservative vote because any Republican would not have pulled what Ben Nelson pulled on the health care, the Obamacare vote, where he was famous for his Cornhusker kickback, the deal that he negotiated in order to vote for the plan, but did eventually vote for the plan, and they needed every single vote. So in a sense, he cast the deciding vote to pass what we now call Obamacare.
And no matter what Republican would have been in Ben Nelson's shoes at the time of that vote, no Republican would have made that vote. Yes, Ben Nelson got a good advantage for Nebraska. Yes, he got out of the Obama administration a concession that many progressive Democrats despised, and he did it for his state, but no Republican would have cast that vote. So, yes, he's a conservative Democrat. He alienated many in his party, but Ben Nelson is the seventh Democrat to retire, and I think the Democrats are in danger of losing many of those seats. In addition to Nebraska, North Dakota, where Kent Conrad is leaving, Herb Kohl in Wisconsin, that could be a toss-up seat. Jim Webb in Virginia, that open seat is tough. And Daniel Akaka's open seat in Hawaii, Yeah, Linda Lingle could, you know, Democrats are not united, even with President Obama on the ballot, favorite son of President Obama. Linda Lingle could win a Senate seat there. Of course, as you well know, first time since Hiram Fong, if it happens.
It would be.
While we always talk about what's in store for 2012, who's going to win the nomination, who's going to win control of the House and Senate, we always spend time at the end of the December podcast to talk about those who passed away in the year and many of whom made a big difference in the political world.
Yes, and I would have to say that of the people who left us in this past year, the one who is most poignant from my point of view is Betty Ford. I wish she was not an elected official, but she was a major political figure as the First Lady, Gerald Ford's wife. But beyond that, she was a public figure with many causes, helped many people dealing with their own personal problems. In her case, of course, she came out about her alcoholism. And, of course, now her name, Grace, is one of the main places where people go for treatment for various kinds of addiction, the Betty Ford Clinic.
She supported abortion rights, which is very unusual for a Republican First Lady, let alone any Republican. She was very candid about her addictions and her illnesses. And, you know, not every conservative Republican in the world liked her, but I remember in the 1976 election, her numbers were far superior to that of her husband, Gerald Ford. While she couldn't carry her husband to victory, she was one of the most beloved First Ladies in our history.
I think that's right. Now, two people have also passed this past year who were on the national ticket of the Democratic Party in, let's say, star-crossed years. Sergeant Shriver, who was the running mate with George McGovern in the fateful year of 1972. They lost 49 states. Shriver got on the ballot after Tom Eagleton had been forced off of the ticket. And
Geraldine Ferraro, in 1984, became the first woman to run for vice president on a major party ticket. Of course, the Mondale-Ferraro ticket, like McGovern-Shriver, also lost 49 out of 50 states, or maybe you could put it more positively, one state. They carried Minnesota. But Geraldine Ferraro, the first woman, she was elected to the House in 1978. She rose through the ranks. And I still remember that San Francisco convention when, you know, just several days prior to that, Mondale named Ferraro as a running mate, and there were tears everywhere, tears of joy, of pride, of stuff that they probably never thought they'd see in their lifetime. Now, ultimately, as we've said all along, running mates do not determine who's going to be elected president. We've seen that over and over again. But for a brief shining moment at that convention in San Francisco, you know, before the John Zaccaro stuff, before all the negative stuff throughout the fall, Geraldine Ferraro was on center stage.
That's right. Four former Republican senators, all retired, left us in 2011. Interestingly, of the four, there were two who, in today's terms, certainly would be considered quite liberal, Charles Percy of Illinois and Mark Hatfield of Oregon.
Yes, and I don't think either Percy or Hatfield could survive in this kind of Republican Party. Charles Percy, of course, first elected to the Senate from Illinois in 1966. He was going to be thought of as a rising star with possible White House ambitions. You know, he was going to succeed Richard Nixon as president in 1976. But once Nixon resigned, Gerald Ford took over. I think Percy's White House hopes went down the drain, but he was highly thought of. And while Mark Hatfield was a true pacifist, he wasn't a knee-jerk liberal, but he was also a beloved figure in Oregon, a former two-term governor and a longtime senator who, when he left the Senate in 1996, there haven't been many Mark Hatfields or, for that matter, Charles Percy's in the Republican conference since then.
The other two senators that I mentioned a moment ago, James McClure from Idaho and Malcolm Wallop from Wyoming, were both closely associated with, if you will, the Ronald Reagan wing of the party before it was fashionable. They were part of the Sagebrush Rebellion, as it was sometimes called, Western senators who believed in small government, energy production, and conservative social values.
Absolutely. Jim McClure and Malcolm Wallop, very conservative, very strong on national defense. They were rugged individualists. They were very strong for development rights. And as Percy and Hatfield represented the Republican left, certainly McClure and Wallop were a strong part of the Republican right in the 1980s and beyond.
That's it for 2011, and that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And in Des Moines, Iowa, I'm Ken Rudin.
Happy New Year, Ken.
Happy New Year to you too, Ron, and I'll see you next week in New Hampshire.
Join us again next week from New Hampshire for It's All Politics from NPR.
Thanks for the memory of sentimental verse, nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse,
how lovely it was.